What does it take to rebuild not just a face, but a life? Welcome back to another episode of White Coats Real Talk. I'm Akshara Anand.
And I'm your co-host, Atharva
And in today's episode is one of the most powerful stories we've ever told. It's about identity, resilience, and the extraordinary science behind rebuilding a human face. Imagine surviving a suicide attempt and waking up with injuries that make you unrecognizable, isolated, and desperate for a second chance. Andy Sednis faced exactly that. It was Mayo Clinic's first face transplant, a surgery that not only rebuilt Andy's face, but gave him back his life. This story is captured in the inspiring book, Face in the Mirror, and we'll explore this pioneering procedure, the team effort behind it, and the human side of medicine that often goes unsaid.
We're truly honored, excited, and thrilled to have Dr. Samir Mardini, a pioneer in reconstructive surgery, join us today. As chair of the Division of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, Dr. Mardini leads a team of plastic surgeons along with hundreds of providers and allied health staff. He's dedicated to delivering exceptional patient care, advancing innovation in the field, and educating the next generation of surgeons. He is not only a gifted surgeon, but also a compassionate storyteller. He understands that when someone loses their face, they're losing much more than physical features. They're losing connection, identity, and confidence. He takes great care to honor each patient's individual needs and aesthetic goals. Thank you so much for being here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you guys. I'm impressed with what you're doing and truly honored to be part of this and would love to share our story of face transplantation at Mayo Clinic and also of Andy's story.
Wonderful. Well, we're really excited to be talking to you today. And me and my brother are both personally, we're reading the book right now, and I think it's truly inspiring. But starting off, in one of your interviews, you said, "I will do everything in my power to give every one of my patients a chance at a normal life." And that dedication is so inspiring for anyone aspiring to enter medicine, and it's truly an honor to have this conversation with you. So we'd like to begin by asking, how's Andy doing now?
Andy is an amazing person. We were very fortunate to meet Andy in 2006. I was on call. It was my first 3 months at Mayo Clinic, and I was on call for Christmas Eve. And Andy had that unfortunate incident at that on that day, and that's when I met him. He was in a bad place. You know, he was drinking. He was arguing with his mother, and made a decision that turned his life around. And imagine, you know, he was in a bad place with a normal face, with a normal physical condition, doing well from a health standpoint, and now he has to deal with the same mental state that he had, with a facial deformity that not only affects his facial aesthetics and how people interact with him, but also the function, being able to eat, being able to not drool, to be able to breathe. And those are things that he had to face and deal with, even, you know, after he had all the negative thoughts and mental state he had. He now has the same thing, but with an injured face. So he struggled with this for years and years, and we'll get into his story. But today he's doing great. He's now 10 years, not 9 years from the face transplant. He's about should be about 19 years from the incident. He's married, he has two kids, and he's living great life. I mean, he's dealing with the same problems that we all deal with in life. Nobody's happy and perfect every single moment. So he's dealing with stuff, but he's living a normal life.
That's amazing and truly inspiring how you came and helped somebody who survived a suicide attempt and now is doing much, much better right now and just enjoying their life. And so his story is very powerful and inspiring. And so when he first came to you, what was his situation really like? How did you approach for someone with that kind of physical and emotional trauma? And what was it like to build the trust needed to plan something and help him go through that and be confident for the surgery?
Yeah, so when I heard that there was somebody flying from another hospital because he's had an injury to his face, and that was, I think it was Christmas Eve. So he came, the initial evaluation is by the trauma team, and the trauma team is looking at it, making sure that he's alive and his spine is stable and his internal organs are not bleeding and that he's going to live. And that's the initial evaluation done at Mayo Clinic. Once that is taken care of, you're then looking at a defect in his face that makes him missing basically everything in his central face. So he has no nose, he has no upper jaw, no lower jaw, no teeth. He's missing his mouth almost completely. It's shattered. The bones are shattered and the lips are sort of split apart. He's got the bones of his orbits are all broken and messed up. He's got little fragments of bullets in his in one of his eye, in both of his eye, one more than the other. So his face is pretty much destroyed. Because if you look at the face, this is the most challenging part to reconstruct, and that's I'm pointing to the mid face area. The nose, the lower eyelids, and everything below, and those are the areas that were affected. So the first thing is you clean up the wound, you get it to like not get infected. So you take him to the operating room a few times, clean up the wounds. There's bone fragments that you take out, there's bone fragments that you put back together. Try to reconstruct as much of his native bones that he has as possible. So we did a lot on his orbital floor, and we put some implants there to hold his eyeball in place. So we reconstructed that, and then we were left with no nose, no upper jaw, and no lower jaw. And so that's when we began the real reconstructions that take a lot of effort and a lot of time. And they require also a donor site, meaning that you have to take it from somewhere in his body. So you're really thinking you're going to take from somewhere to reconstruct somewhere else. And you have to make decisions about whether that's the right thing or to not. So for example, the way we reconstruct the mandible very commonly is we take the fibula bone. The fibula bone with an artery and vein, we take the skin that's overlying it, the lateral part of the leg, and then we transfer that, we make cuts, and we shape it to look like a mandible. And then the skin can form the outer covering. And then the upper jaw, we took bone from the iliac crest with artery and vein. So the bone is transplanted, but from one person to the To, it's another part of his body. You connect the vessels in the face with microsurgical techniques, and then now that lives as well. So you have now two bones that were transplanted, some soft tissue, some skin, and it's starting to have structure to the face. And then in those bones, you put implants, and then you put like some sort of a denture that's permanent. It's called an oral prosthesis or dental prosthesis, and that's how you work. But the thing is, when the first thing that I thought is, once we got to the point where we're ready to reconstruct and do with those bigger surgeries that take us 8 to 12 hours or more sometimes, I was wondering, is someone like him and that has had this incident, is he likely to do it again? And that was really a part that I didn't really understand or know. And I reached out to our colleagues in psychiatry and said, I don't want to put this guy through hell for 2, 3 months of multiple surgeries, and then after that, he's going to try to commit suicide again. Because what happens to these people that go through that? And they evaluated Andy, and they I think every situation is unique, and they felt that he's very unlikely to do something like that again. So we proceeded with the reconstructions.
I know a lot of people, when we think of organ donation, we usually think of hearts or kidneys. But in a facial transplant, what exactly is being donated? I'm sure it's not just the skin. And does it like include deeper structures such as muscles, nerves, or even bone? Can you kind of explain what's involved within the facial transplant procedure?
Yeah, so the field is called vascularized composite tissue allotransplantation, and that is because the hands, the upper extremity, the face, those are lumped into this vascularized composite tissue allotransplantation field because it's made up of different tissue types. Like a heart, that's one muscle and everything that comes along with it. It has skin and muscles and nerves and vessels, and then you can also go under the underlying structures as well as any part of the bones of the face, pretty much. So the facial transplants, it's an ultimate and individualized medicine. There's no defect, and if you look at the 50 plus patients that have been done around the world today, no patient has the exact same defect, right? They're very very similar in some ways and different in other ways. Every patient, you evaluate your patient and see what they need. You decide if those patients are a candidate for face transplant because you've reached a point with reconstructive surgery, the traditional reconstructive surgery, where you feel like you're not going to benefit the patient much more continuing on that track. You think about face transplantation. If you think the patient is a candidate for face transplant, then you have to really think about the surgery and how it would go. So if someone like our patient is missing this part of the face, which includes the nose, the upper jaw, the lower jaw, you're trying to reconstruct that part. So then you know the obvious part is the part that's deformed. That you have to remove and restore with from a donor. But then if you're trying to get a good aesthetic unit and a functional unit together, you often have to go beyond that. So for example, in our patient Andy, when we first started talking about it, we had an idea of what we wanted to do. So we went to the cadaver lab. And over a 3-year period, we went to the cadaver lab over 50 Saturdays, really thinking about what we would want to do initially, understanding the anatomy, finding the protocol for Andy's defect in particular, and then training the team. So you're asking me about defining the protocol, like what are the structures that you need to figure out, you need to bring from the donor. So we looked at a few things. What we thought is this is the central face that he needs. So that's the nose, upper jaw, lower jaw. But in order for him to look good and function in a good manner, we thought we'd have the incisions go in front of the ear. So then you're removing a lot of his normal tissues. We take the majority of the upper jaw, lower jaw with the teeth. We bring the nose from the donor. And then we'd bring all the infraorbital rim, all the orbital structures that are below the eyeball with the teeth. All of that we would bring to restore a good functional unit and an aesthetic unit, which would mean then when you're doing the surgery, you have a donor surgery and you have a recipient surgery. This recipient is your patient. The donor surgery, you're removing all these parts that we're talking about. And on the recipient, you're having to remove a lot of tissue to accommodate that donor. So after 21 hours of removing tissue from the recipient, our patient, if when you look at his face, you only see eyeballs in the back of the throat. There's no other tissues there. It's all been removed. And you're hoping to restore all of that in one with one organ, one unit from the donor. So it's quite an extensive operation. And sometimes in order to make it look good and function well, you have to do a lot more than you would initially imagine.
And you mentioned that for some of the hearts, you guys use Andy's actual tissue. So how does a donor really, for a face transplant, get matched to a recipient? And what is recovery like after the face transplant? Are patients able to smile, eat, or even speak again?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there are a few things that we match in this field of VCA, face transplant, upper extremity transplant, such as blood type. We match the EBV, Epstein-Barr virus, which is the mono virus. We try to match it. So someone who's been exposed versus not, they tend to have blood cancers if you transplant them. We look at the skin color. We don't want it to be too far off because you don't want to attract attention. These patients are they're trying to They want to live a normal life. They don't want to be recognized that they're different or they had a face transplant. They just want to be able to walk down the street and not be noticed. So skin color, we look at the size match, and then we look at age as well and gender. So age, there's not like a strict rule for age. You have to decide as a team what you think is appropriate for the patient. Maybe the patient can contribute to that discussion. Ours was plus or minus 12 years. And with Andy's donor, it was about 10 years younger. And so there's a match with kidney and heart and others. There's a little bit more because there's more donors out there. They're able to be a little bit more picky in trying to get the perfect match. So they're able to match HLA, which is a histocompatibility complex that if you match, your likelihood of rejection is a little bit less. And then at the time of surgery, the donor itself, they mix the serums together and see if there's any immediate reaction that could tell you if the recipient is presensitized to some of the antigens on that donor, because that would really cause the rejection very quickly. So those are the things that we match.
Amazing. And who typically qualifies for a face transplant? And what kind of injuries or even conditions might lead to needing one? And how did you know that Andy was truly really suitable, knowing the wait for a suitable donor can be so unpredictable and can take a long time?
Yes, at Mayo Clinic, we have a multidisciplinary team that we have as part of our face transplant team. It's made up of people from different disciplines. So, as a surgeon, I'm seeing patients that have facial deformities. And when I think We have a patient that, if I mapped out further reconstructions, I feel like they're only going to reach a certain point of function and aesthetics that is inadequate. I may consider them for face transplantation. And so I bring them to the face transplant, multidisciplinary face transplant team, and then the real vetting begins, because they're going to look at the psychiatric aspect, and we're going to look at psychosocial aspects. We're going to look at the health of the patient, see if they can tolerate immunosuppression, if they can tolerate a long surgery, see if the patient, one of the real challenges is making sure that the patient really understands what they're getting themselves into, because making an informed decision is extremely important. So the patient also has a waiting period. We don't ever sign someone up right away. Unlike if you came in and your appendix was ruptured, you would sign a consent the same second and say, "I want you to do my surgery." We do not allow for an immediate listing of the patient. There has to be a minimum of 90 days, and usually takes much longer, where the patient gets information, comes back for more information, gets more information, and when the team believes that that patient is fully informed, then we can list the patient. So the patient has to be have the proper anatomic defect. They have to be fully informed about the procedure. When we map out their course of reconstructive surgery, which we do for every patient, if they've had multiple reconstructions, we then map out of further reconstructive, like with conventional techniques, what it would look like. It may be like 20 surgeries with 20 recoveries, and at the end, the function is going to be missing this and this and that. And we say, well, with face transplant, we can restore in two operations, or one big one and a couple of small ones. We can get the patient to function much better and not be missing anything else. So that is how we make a decision. From the patient standpoint, they need to be also, we like them to have, of course, the medical condition, the immunosuppression for the rest of their lives, which is a big deal. And then the patient needs to be brave and want to sign up for this. It is a new field. If you think about it, there's been thousands of stomach resections, and thousands and hundreds of thousands of appendectomies, and all these other surgeries that you hear and see. This one, there's only been 50 plus surgeries. It's a new field. The patient has to really want to be part of that, and has to see that that's clearly good for them. That's how we pick the patients. On our side, the medical side, we have to prepare. Technically, we have to have a program, which we started in 2013, and we have to have a relationship with a patient that allows us to take them through this challenging journey. And Andy was the perfect guy for us, because we got to know him over many, many years. I had a relationship with him as his surgeon. Many of the Mayo Clinic team members had a relationship with him because they took care of him over the years, including our dental specialists and many others. And then when we put him with the multidisciplinary transplant team, everybody got to know him really well. At some point, it was clear to everybody that he was the right patient. And he has been. After he went through a tough surgery, he came in top shape. He was muscles and good fit. And he mentioned, like, "You guys told me I need to do my part. You'll do your part. You guys are going to do your part, and now I need to do my part." So he came back very fit, and after surgery, he was very motivated. And then the nice thing about it is also, he's been such a pleasure to work with on a personal level. He's shared his story through this book and through other things with the world. He's sat down with some of the team members. Like, he was kind enough to meet with our some of the operating room staff that helped him, and talk to them and met them, and they wanted to be part of this. So it's been a real pleasure to work with him. He's just a wonderful human being.
Yeah, it's really mind-blowing to hear the story straight from you and your perspective, because leading such a huge team and then going through with the surgery and all the preparation before it, and then even Andy being ready for the surgery was such a scary operation, and I'm sure it was very, very painful after the operation was done. It's really impressive and inspiring to hear. And we know obviously there was an incredible amount of preparation for the surgery, but were there any challenges that arose during the operation that your team or you hadn't anticipated beforehand?
So we went into this initially. It was a few years of trying to build the program. And that means getting institutional support, meaning basically you have to take all the steps to have Mayo Clinic at the end say, We believe that this is something that we need at Mayo Clinic. We believe that we will have patients that need this kind of surgery, and we're supportive of you doing it. We'll provide every kind of resource you need to do that. It took us a few years to get to that point. First of all, talking about it, sharing the story of face transplant from around the world, going through ethics. There's a lot of ethical discussions about face transplant. We went through all of that, and finally we got approval to do it, to do the surgery. And you can imagine when you get that kind of approval, you've been talking so much, so passionate about getting this done for your patients, and now you have to actually accomplish that goal. And that comes with a big, big responsibility, because these patients, they're coming to you, they're not coming, they don't just want to have a face transplant. Their goal is they want to have a normal life. So they're going to also commit themselves to lifelong immunosuppression. They're going to take these medications for the rest of their life that weakens their immune system. That has to be a worthwhile thing for them. You know, in medicine, it's always a risk benefit. Is it worth the risk because the benefit is so good? That's something that they that has to be weighed out. So for us, as a surgical, as a team of surgeons wanting to do the right thing for our patients, we felt incredibly responsible to do everything possible to make the surgery, give Andy the best outcome you can imagine. And that's tough because you've never done it before, and you don't really know what it's gonna look like or function like at the end. But what we can do is prepare. And so that was I traveled around the world, met a lot of the surgeons, or met, there weren't a lot of them. I met three or four of the surgeons that had done some face transplants. They were very kind and generous in opening up their hospitals and clinics to us, talking to their patients and learning. So I wanted to learn from other people's mistakes and what they've done right. And then we studied Andy's deformity and defect. Then we went to the cadaver lab. And in the cadaver lab, you have the opportunity to work with people who've donated their bodies for clinical care and science. And that is the most valuable opportunity that we had in making sure Andy got a good outcome, because we spent hours and hours in the cadaver lab. And what that allows you to do is you study the anatomy, you see it in real time, and then you're able to rehearse the operation. So we wanted to be prepared for the surgery. So we did the surgery over and over again in the cadaver lab, to the point where we mastered the surgery, and then we did this over and over again after that. That allowed us to pick on every detail about where we make incisions, what skin do we replace, where do we make the bony cuts, you know, what happens if this happens. We had many discussions with the team. We brought this technology called virtual surgical planning. So we got CAT scans. You got a CAT scan, the three-dimensional of the donor and the recipient in the cadaver lab. And then we're able to plan the surgery. And then this company we worked with, called 3D System Medical Modeling, they give you guides that you clip onto the bones. And then the saw goes in specific slots, so the bones are cut exactly right. So when you move the donor to the recipient, it fits perfectly. So we did all that so that when the surgery came, we didn't want to have any things that we weren't prepared for. That was our goal. Now, the surgery went incredibly smoothly. Took a long time. It was 56 hours. We had two rooms at the same time, first with the donor and the recipient. That took about 21 to 23 hours. And then we moved the organ to one room, and then we kept going with the operation for the rest of the 56 hours. The only thing that, you know, and comments from people in the around us, like some of the nurses that work with us on our normal surgeries, were that when we walked in, we were expecting it to be kind of a chaotic environment where things are new and everybody's trying to figure things out. And we just saw a surgery that was going as smoothly as everyday surgeries. So we had rehearsed enough that it actually was like we've done it so many times. The one thing that did happen that was, you know, unexpected and really was a challenge was we put the bones together, and next is to put the vessels together. So we put the artery and the vein, and then you get this flush of blood into the face, and the face turns pink, and it's a wonderful feeling. And then I took a break for a few minutes while my colleagues were plating the mandible, putting plates and screws to get the mandible bones together. And I got called back into the room because the face turned white. And so there was no longer any perfusion to the face. So we came back, looked very carefully at the vessels. The vessels looked okay, but they weren't really, the blood wasn't going through them, but they didn't look like there was a problem. So we spent about 40 minutes with the face completely white, which was an incredibly scary feeling because there's at some point there's nothing you can do, you know, and we kept trying different things. And I chased the artery all the way into the face where nobody had been. We hadn't really touched the artery there, and found a part of the artery that was completely spastic and constricted, and opened it up, and the face turned pink. And that was probably the part of the operation was the most emotionally and physically challenging, just trying to figure that part out. And then the operation kept going and going, connecting the nerve so you can get function, selective function of each part of the face. And fortunately, Andy, has a result that has allowed him to live, walk down the street, talk to people. People may think he's, oh, what happened? Did you have an accident? Why do you have scars on your face here and there? But they don't, nobody ever asks him, or maybe nobody would even ask that kind of question. But nobody thinks that he had something as drastic as a face transplant.
Yeah, I think what you guys did was really incredible, and how you guys fixed his face and he's doing much better. And also learning about Rudy the donor, I believe, and his wife Lily, to decision to say yes was really incredibly moving. And honestly, hearing their story inspired me to get really involved in organ donation awareness myself, to really help people understand how donations can truly transform lives. So can you please talk about how the role of donor families in making face transplants really possible? And how do you really approach those incredibly delicate conversations and helping them understand that they could save lives?
So we work with every region in the country has an organ procurement organization, and those people are incredible people. Their lives are all organ donation. They're the ones that organize organ donation, and they assign organs based on the match of different things that we talked about earlier. So our team here is called LifeSource. Our organ procurement organization for our region is called LifeSource. They're based in St. Paul, and those are the people that help us do all the things you're mentioning. As you know, the surgeon themselves don't get involved with the discussions with the families, but we're involved in discussions of what we want, what would work, how to build a program. So we worked with them for a couple of years when we were establishing our program to try to figure out, how do we, the whole thing, face transplant in general. And then they went and talked to other organ procurement organizations around the country, mostly the Massachusetts one. They had done some transplants at Brigham and Women's, and they learned as much as they can from them. And then they came back and sort of educated their team on how to approach a patient, a donor family that is going to donate the kidney or the lungs, and just to say, there's a patient at Mayo Clinic, or there's a patient somewhere in the region that is in need of a face. It's something that you probably never heard of before, but it's an opportunity for you to give the gift of facial donation to someone who really needs it, who's living a very low quality life. Is this something that you'd be willing to do? Because unlike the solid organs, where you can sign off on your driver's license, this is something a family has to decide. So the really amazing part of the story is the donor was 21, and his wife was, I think, 18 or 19. She was 8 months pregnant, and she was 8 months pregnant. She was the one that had to make the decision about donating the face. You can imagine the challenge of that. Her high school sweetheart just passed away, and now she has to make a really tough decision about something. And she was incredibly brave and thoughtful. And in an interview that I met her once, but didn't really have conversations with her, she mentions that somebody asked her, like, why did you accept that? And she says, I wanted my child to see what his father had done to help so many other people. And that's the gift that God gave her to kind of get through this period. And you might know a lot about this, the whole thing about organ donation. It's a horrific, tough time for a family who lost a loved one, and there's an opportunity to give a gift of organ donation to a person that needs it to save their lives, or needs it to save their to improve the quality of their lives. And in that tough moment, you have that spirit of donating something so valuable and so important. And so I think it's heartwarming to see how good people can be. And I heard this this phrase which goes around in some of the organ procurement organization, which says, "Don't take your organs to heaven. Heaven knows we need them here." That's just something that sometimes I think about, and it's very, very striking. We were very fortunate, or Andy was very fortunate that the family of Rudy was willing to donate his face. He had a chance to meet them. That's out there on YouTube, and that was incredibly special that she got to meet her husband's recipient. She got to touch the face. The son was born at the, had already been like maybe it was a year old, and Andy was carrying the son, and the son was touching his father's face. It was very, very, very moving. So yeah, I think there's stories like this every day in the world of organ donation, whether it's a heart or a kidney or a liver. I think it's a special world that if you're involved in any way, I think you'll be inspired.
I mean, I can't even and like fathom the kind of decision you have to make for something like this. And as Lily, like it's truly, truly impressive and brave of her to make such a decision, such a huge decision in a time of sorrow. But it's her decision that gave Andy a new face. And I think that's really, really impressive and it's cool. But in that moment, after years and years of preparation and a 56-hour long surgery, as a surgeon, how did you feel? And what was that experience like to see Lily seeing Andy's face and Andy seeing himself for the first time?
Incredibly moving. Every part of the story has been life-changing. One of the pioneers in face transplant, his name is Laurent Melentieri. He's a good friend of mine. He's a surgeon in Paris. And when I was talking to him early on in the process, he said that the patients tell him that that he changed their lives, and he would tell them back that you've changed my life. And I always remember that because I think my life has been touched by an incredible transformation of another human being. And we go into medicine to help others, and this is a very, very powerful example of it. So it's been very moving in many, many ways. So for me, the surgery itself, 56 hours, I was awake the whole time doing delicate surgery. My team members were awake doing really challenging parts of the surgery. The nurses were working over, like they would try to send them home, and they wouldn't agree just to go home. They just didn't want to leave. They wanted to be part of this. They wanted to help out. And to see the team come together to help another human being, that was huge for me. The accomplishment itself of the technical aspect was really rewarding, great to see. But to see Andy initially wake up after a few days, wake up that he was alive, that his face was alive, that was very special and rewarding. But there was a period of time where he started to get a function on his face only on one side, and it took a few weeks for the other side to start working. During that time, it was very, it was a little bit scary because if you only had one side moving, despite the success of the face transplant not by being alive, that wouldn't be a successful outcome. So we had to deal with things like that along the way. But when I saw Andy look at his face for the first time in the mirror, we were all kind of wondering what's going on with him. And he had a tracheostomy, so he wasn't speaking at that time. We asked him, "How does it feel?" And he wrote down on a piece of paper, "Far exceeded my expectations." You can imagine for us as a team what that, how great that was to hear. And he did well over time. And for the time that he this is something that was very special. 2 days or 3 days after he saw himself in the mirror for the first time, I was rounding on him in the morning, and I just said, "Hey, how's it going? What's happening?" He said, "I told you that I would share with you interesting parts of the story when it happened. I'm going to share with you something." I say, "What's going on?" And he said, For the past 10 years, when I had a dream, I always saw my original face in the dreams. I never ever saw my deformed face in my dreams. It was never part of my dreams. And last night I had a dream and I saw my new face in the dreams." So he immediately embraced the new face, and that became his face. And so, to be part of those moments was really great. He didn't date for 10 years that he had the facial deformity. He started dating this lovely person, and then they got married, and now they have two kids. So the whole thing's just been incredible. The teamwork, the collaboration, the goodness that you see in people building the team here at Mayo Clinic, and how people really wanted to work together to do this. And then Andy and his story themselves, and the generosity of the donor and the donor family, those things were just very, very moving.
Yeah, I can tell it's really moving and it's incredibly amazing, and not just because of the medical complexity, but because of the human side. And so, regarding organ donation, what are the biggest barriers to increasing public awareness about face tissue organ donation? How can we change that and increase and bring more awareness about how organ donation can really help and change many people's lives?
That is a very important question. I think there's a lot being done for heart, kidneys, and lungs. It's a life-saving organ. It's very obvious to people how a heart is necessary to keep someone alive. Kidney maybe a little bit less so, but there's a lot of education on that. People have to go and spend hours and hours in dialysis chambers and rooms and deal with all the stuff that goes along with that. But with facial transplantation, it's a very new thing, and it's very hard for people to imagine their loved one not having a face when they're being buried. That's a big part. So I think, like this book, Face in the Mirror, that Jack Elhai wrote about Mayo Clinic story, Andy's story, I think that's those kind of things can be very helpful to see the other side of it and the transformation that can happen as a result of the gift. One of the things that we've done with Andy's donation, or with Derek's donation, is we restore the donor face to an almost identical face as what they had. So we have an anaplastologist that they do prosthesis. Their daily jobs is doing ear prosthesis, nasal prosthesis, eyelid prosthesis. That's what they do every day. They brought that kind of level of dedication and that level of skill to restoring the donor face. So before we start the operation, they go and they do a melange of the face, and then they take pictures, and they work for 14 hours on the side, doing layer after layer of to create wrinkles, freckles, the shape. Everything looks 100% identical to the donor, with the colors and everything. And then that silicone mass is put back onto the face of the donor after the whole thing has been removed. And that's sutured in, and then you can have an open casket, so that there is an opportunity for an open casket. There's the donor family understands that their loved one is being buried with their body restored. And I think the same things that apply to all of organ donation, I think those things are happening every day. When people, stories, movies, educational material, and people, and then the organ procurement organizations themselves, they're so compassionate and skilled at discussing with families. That's also important. The other thing is making other made some of the hospitals need to be aware of how the process goes, and which candidates are potential donors. That's also there. And then there's a putting signing up in your license that you want to be an organ donor is another thing that I think there's education out there for that.
And we would also love to talk to you about another side of your work that's just as inspiring. And beyond high-tech surgeries at Mayo, you've also led about 30 volunteer mission trips worldwide, helping over 700 children with cleft, craniofacial, and other facial differences. Can you or share what these trips have meant to you personally and how they shaped you as a surgeon?
Yeah, that's something that I've really valued and enjoyed in my career. I did my residency at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and then I went out to Taiwan to do fellowships. They have a really strong program in reconstructive microsurgery and cleft lip and palate and craniofacial surgery. And that's when I got introduced to going on trips. There, they had a foundation called the Nordhoff Cleft and Craniofacial Foundation. And we went to the Philippines, a place called General Santos, and we went to another place in Cambodia, and we did cleft lip and palate surgery. And I found that to be fascinating. Just the whole experience of going there and helping, working in a different environment, doing the volunteer surgeries, doing a lot of these surgeries on patients that really needed the gratification you get from the families thanking you, and the way that people would come from 10, 12 hours away They would wait to be evaluated. We'd evaluate 200 people, but you can only operate on 50 people. The other 150 have to be told that they have to come back for the next trip. That was really something that touched me and meant a lot to me. So when I came back, I got involved with an organization called Smile Network International here in the Twin Cities, and I've gone with them on missions sometimes 3 weeks a year. Some years have been 2 weeks a year, and it's been very rewarding and fun. It gives you a lot of skills too, because you're doing a lot of one surgery at a time, one or two operations over and over again during the week. That's always good. But the joy you get and the satisfaction you get from helping people in need is a real pleasure. And you know, when you go on vacation, you go to a country, you explore as a tourist that country. You're going to countries that, like, we've been to Mexico, multiple cities there, Peru, Armenia, and Cambodia, and Philippines, and you're going and working with the people there. You're in the hospital working with the people there. It's a special experience. And you guys should consider going on one.
And I'm sure it is. I think it'll be an incredible feeling helping people and going on mission trips and helping people in need. And so we've talked to many doctors, and some doctors said that they started with the specialty in mind and then suddenly switched to a different one. And I believe that in the book, you mentioned that your first choice was pediatric cardiology. What led you to shift to plastic surgery, and how did you know that was the right fit for you?
I went into surgery wanting to do a pediatric cardiac surgery. So I liked the children's heart. My father's a pediatric cardiologist. I liked the concept of a small baby with a heart issue. I felt like I can make a real difference in someone's life. So I went into surgery with that in mind. And honestly, I kind of fell into plastic surgery. Unlike many people who were passionate about plastic surgery the day they started, I was passionate about pediatric cardiac surgery. And in my third year of general surgery at the Georgetown University, MedStar Georgetown University, there was a position that opened up in plastic surgery, and somebody just approached me asking me if I'm interested, and I said not really. And then I had a couple of discussions here and there, and somehow they offered me the position. And I just had to, like, my whole mind, I had to transform my whole life image of who I was and into this. So it was a challenging transition for me, because I couldn't find exactly where my passion was in plastic surgery initially. And the plastic surgery is such a wonderful field, and it has so many different aspects to it. So it was hard finding between going to hand surgery and going into breast surgery and aesthetic surgery, and there was so many things to explore. And I finally found my passion in challenging reconstructive cases all over the body. I thought that was really, really awesome. And then over time, I got more and more interested in and into facial reconstruction and craniofacial surgery. But still, till today, my practice involves everything, because we work in a big hospital. So we are often called to different specialties to reconstruct a leg or a thigh, or something else like an infection after cardiac surgery. Sometimes we're involved with that. So we still do everything, although we have a focus, and my focus has been mostly on the face. So yeah, it took a while. And when I went to Taiwan, there's a hospital there called Changgang Memorial Hospital where they are really intense about their surgeries, and I was had an opportunity to explore many different aspects of reconstructive surgery, and found my passion in doing these complicated reconstructions.
It's amazing. It's so cool that a lot of people just think of one thing and then somehow life leads them to another specialty. And then you end up doing a lot, inspiring so many people. And so, if you could speak directly to an audience or and have a message for them about organ donation, what would you say? And how can they be advocates for organ donation and really reach out and inform people about how this can really help so many people in the world?
Yeah, I mean, they're for facial transplantation. We have patients that are that we that our last patient, Derek, he had 58 surgeries, tough surgeries, somewhere else before coming to us. And after those 58 surgeries, his face was completely deformed. He wasn't able to keep food in his mouth. He wasn't able to breathe without a tracheostomy. He was missing so many structures in his face. Their lives are completely destroyed, even though they're alive. and to do more reconstruction. He had also some parts of his body where like his arms were contracted because there was so much tissue taken from there to reconstruct his face. And so he limps a little bit when he walks. He's got a lot of parts of his body that are involved in the reconstructions. You know, what else are you going to do for a patient like that? You're going to do small things that are going to really not make any difference in his face. So someone like him, his whole life can transform. And not only can you give him a little bit of an improvement, you can put him in the category of a normal person, normal life, normal face. And I think that is something that, you know, we always say that facial organ donation, it may not be life saving, but it's life giving. So there are people out there that are missing a real significant aspect of their life, and that can help them out. So for heart and kidney and lungs, it's there are people dying every day because they can't get a liver, they can't get a heart. I think for us, if you know, if you reach a point where you're no longer you know, alive, your brain is no longer alive, but your organs are functional and you can help someone else, and I think that's a miracle that we should take advantage of.
And to end off today's episode, what's one piece of advice you'd share with young people who dream of working in the medical field?
I think remember that you're in this field to help other people. And if you're passionate about helping other people and you see that as your main goal, you're gonna do everything you can to make that happen for them. I think one of the things that I found to be valuable, and I tell the people, our trainees, is gather as many tools in your toolbox. Don't be so set on learning only one thing. Gather as many tools in your toolbox as you can, because you never know how those are going to help you. And I saw that with my training in craniofacial surgery and reconstructive microsurgery and all these things that together they you know, I learned so many operations that I didn't do after finished my training, but they all were part of face transplant, the face transplant procedure. I never thought at that point that we were going to do a face transplant. But I just like to learn, and I wanted to build as much skill as I could and learn as many things as I could, because I never knew when I was going to need them. I think learn as much as you can, and focus on your passion and your desire to help other people.
Well, Dr. Mardini, thank you so much for joining us today and this truly remarkable conversation about this incredibly inspiring procedure that you and your team have accomplished. And today we heard more than just about an extraordinary surgical achievement. We heard about the human spirit and the second chances, and what's also possible when science and compassion work hand in hand. Stories like Andy's teach us that the greatest innovations in medicine come from empathy, teamwork, and never giving up.
We also learned about the importance of organ donation, how one family's unimaginable loss becomes another person's chance at life and hope. And it's a very powerful reminder that we're all connected in ways we might not always see. So thank you for listening. This is White Coast Real Talk. Until next time.